Okay, now question two is, you sometimes just want to scream, wake up to the organization, sensing all around you dangers. You're seeing dangers. You're in an environment where suddenly it's so. And then how do you set about informing in a sensible, factual way the value and need of a stronger innovation program? And I pick up on one particular comment made was, you know, we'd love to innovate, but all the money is allocated to support the core, very little for exploring out. So, you know, this screaming, and of course, then we get into one of the top things I spoke very early on about, is you can become the whipping boy. You become the, you know, you're starting to play politics because you're the messenger. How do you deal with this? How would you try to manage and sort of take a pathway through this, Laszlo?
All right, so a couple of things. So one is I absolutely recognize the problem, right? It is a real challenge, and it certainly depends on the level of the challenge depends on the kind of organization you work in. If you're fortunate enough to work in Google, which has this unbelievable entrepreneurial culture, spirit, structure that demands that you bring new creative ideas or work on other people's creative ideas, right? That is the culture. You must participate. Versus more traditional command and control organizations that allocate everything to the core, and it's all about managing the business. Those are two very different experiences for an employee. But one of the things that could bridge those gaps is we get invited in all the time to do innovation strategy work, right? So we bring the leadership group together and have them understand what are these signals of the future, pull together a strategy about how they want to go forward, and of course, they look at these signals, they figure out the fields and the places where they want to play, and now this becomes a strategy, and any ideas that bubble up from the bottom are already greeted with some enthusiasm because entrepreneurship is seen as part of the solution for getting the organization to move forward. And so we can have easy conversations with leaders about creating an innovation infrastructure or architecture if it hasn't been built and funding that appropriately so that when people have ideas, there is funding, there is support.
How can you as an innovator seed that idea? So, yeah, I mean, bridge the gaps, get into the leadership group. Every day we love to do that.
Yeah. How wonderful it is to work in those environments, yeah.
Well, you know, how do you get that poor guy who's got the problems, got the dilemmas, sees the future in a particular way, what can you provide him as sets of either tools or thinking for him to be able to sort of lay the foundation?
Well, so a couple of things. Let me come to that, and I will give you one more example. Because waking the organization up is not an easy thing to do. Obviously, there are things that people could do on the side. They can invite executives to come speak to them, and all hands, lunch and learn. You can bring the outside world into your organization. And help collectively wake it up. And you can do that around your own area, your own part of the business from industry outsiders. We had the pleasure of working with Andy Parfit, who's the head of Radio 1 at BBC. And he was struggling with his numbers as the flagship radio of Europe. This is like 10, 15 years ago. And he recognized that his people were actually, quite frankly, they were playing music that they liked, but had lost track of what the larger British and European music scene was in. So after spending a week with him, teaching him about the discipline of innovation, when he got back, now keep in mind, he only had a staff of 50, 60 at the time. Over the next 3 months, he sent the staff out into Britain and said, I want you to go hang out with people enjoying music. Just go out, spend an evening, a day, whatever that is, record it and take photographs of the people, whether you're in their house, whether you're at a concert, whether you're at a club, whether you're in any of those events. And they came back sort of re-inspired and reconnected to what their audience, their customers were about. Andy didn't have to dictate anything. He woke the entire station up about what was going on. And one of the beauties of it was he had them put those pictures along the hallway in the entrance to Radio 1. So every morning when you walked in, there were pictures of hundreds of people who were enjoying sort of music in Britain. And they created a new creative calendar that allowed them pick their big major events and tailor them around the music needs of the country and put it in an innovation process where people would pitch their ideas. They reconnected to other DJs and they turned the corner. So anyway, it was all to say, yes, it really helps when you have a leader who's willing to wake up and sort of champion these things.
Give an example of something that happened to me in a workshop environment. This is really a research and development group. And big, large company.
Yes.
Very, very respected company. Has got a good track record of development of product. The R&D guys were not allowed to attend conferences. They were not allowed to be with customers. They were totally reliant on Salesforce coming back or marketing people informing them. So
right.
They spent a growing amount of their time trying to listen to a filter to be able to do the job they were doing.
Right.
You know, this is the sort of thing that, you know, just drives you down. We got into a conversation. The leadership was in the room with the team. The team got animated. They got really excited about the idea. The leadership killed it because it was not their practice.
Now,
okay, you think, they're not going to last. They have lasted and they're still thriving as an organization.
Yeah.
So there are things that they're doing right, but there are certainly things that they're doing wrong. How would you tackle something like that if that was, you know, suddenly you were confronted with that?
Well, here's a technique we've used, and it's one that sort of grew off of one of my early experiences when I was a real junior consultant, and one of my first clients was a big healthcare client here in Silicon Valley, and they I was talking to a group of physicians who can be some of the most resistant sort of practitioners and managers and influencers inside an organization because they're taking personal responsibility for their patients and the delivery of care, right? So they take this very seriously. And we were getting nowhere, even though we thought we had some really good ideas that they would be excited about. But rather than continuing to push them and get the resistance back, I was able to talk them into going down to the other side of the bay, down the road, and see this brand new surgery center that had just opened up that had many of the ideas that we'd sort of circled from our conversations at their own hospital. And they went, all right. So I dragged them off there, and they spent a half day. They talked to the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, the patients. The senior administrators got really excited, came back and said, yes, we got to have that. So being able to actually introduce them to something like that and have, I always say, the best discovery, self-discovery, having them go to a place and see and experience what's possible is so much more powerful than trying it yourself. Now, we've elevated that to what we call Silicon Valley immersion programs. So we get 6-8 clients a year to fly into Silicon Valley for a week, whether it's a project team, right, or one or two people, or the entire executive group, to come in and spend a week here, not only visiting some of the iconic organizations, right? This is not a petting zoo experience where you go, hey, look, there's Facebook with a picture with your thumb up, but actually meeting the people who are working on things and projects that are relevant to the client. We teach them innovation best practices, and we do this strategy process at the end so they can synthesize their learning and create a roadmap into the future. So we turn it literally into an immersion. They get soaked up into this crazy world. And there's no one who's come to those events who's left has not been transformed. When you see that people are reinventing your industry and your business all over the world at 100 miles an hour, and you are still prodding along based on your old management establishment and products and services, you suddenly wake up in a big way. But you also get excited, right? There's a bit of scare in it. And also, wow, look at the possibilities. We can do things we never thought we could do before.
Yeah, but it's an interesting one because I think I was going to bring up the point that where you sit and, of course, where this really can change significantly, wake up people, as you say, sitting there in Silicon Valley, you've got an enormous advantage.
True.
If people make the pilgrimage, they're going to obviously get, I think, a lot out of it. They're going to get a lot more converted.
Yeah.
What I tend to find, though, is when people try to jump back on the plane, they come back into their environment.
Yeah.
If one takes the European, certainly less open-minded, certainly less sort of exploratory, they tend to sort of close back down into the work they're doing, validating again what they've been doing and saying, well, it's still doing well.
Yeah.
Well, we went to Silicon Valley. Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, it's all popping and moving and shaking. well, we're doing okay. We're moving along fine, you know, and of course we're not.
Yeah.
How do you bridge a little bit the cultures that come flooding in? Not from the, you know, tick the box. Yes, fantastic experience. Yeah, I'm really going to do something. How do you follow up, and how do you then sort of get people to say, yeah, right, I've truly woken up. I've truly become a convert. But some of the things you've talked about, some of the things you've demonstrated. What's your thinking?
That's great. No, no, you raise a great point. It can be a tremendous shock to go back into the enterprise that you just left. So you can do a couple of things. So one is, I said, we put together a plan for them. So they're not walking in cold. They already know who they need to talk to and the kinds of things they need to get done going forward. So it's not a sort of a totally cold reentry back into the organization. When they're here as well, we look for them to start building relationships and potential partnerships with people they can work with. So already they keep part of this connection back to various startups, or if they join an incubator like or accelerator like Plug and Play, so they're part of the corporate group that has these startups on a regular basis. Again, people reinventing your industry every single day, threatening to disrupt you. But that allows a steady stream of startups to sort of exist in their mindset, and also that they can partner with, acquire, other kinds of things like that. Clients have set up outposts, so they've left either people behind or set up. Swisscom did this for years. We had a wonderful relationship with them that allowed them to find out what they were. They were basically, if you talked with Ursula, she said we were a year ahead of what was going on in Europe all the time because we were at the cutting edge of telecom by being here in Silicon Valley.
I always remember a story that Ursula told me when we met.
Yeah, you met Ursula Osterte, yeah.
And her comment was, what was so useful was the leadership of that company decided to take all its managers across into Silicon Valley. And it said, we're not going all at once, but we're going to progressively take everybody. So it becomes it seeps into our culture.
Right.
Because every one of us can go there and get their own sense and their own feeling of what it means. So when they come back, they've got themselves this greater sort of power of sort of understanding to be able to really advance forward their thinking as an organization.
Yeah. I love it. No, you're absolutely right. I've also seen clients say you're in Switzerland or Europe, you can actually create space inside your own office buildings for startups to work. You can give them resources to get them started. And so they literally existing inside your own buildings and people can spend time with them. I've watched groups deliberately make customer training take place inside their own headquarters so that people can see customers and touch them when they come visit for training sessions. Because if I had to go one way to sort of wake my organization up and I was introvert, I would do it with our own customer data. I would say our customers are changing, they're transforming, they're asking for new things all the time. And we need to be out ahead of that. And that's usually data that an entrepreneur inside the organization, unless they've been forbidden, that was a rough story of R&D not even being allowed to talk to people, unless they've been forbidden to talk to them, getting customer data, market data, because usually the data is quite insightful and the sales and marketing people recognize the world is changing and often want better solutions.
I think in coming towards a sort of summary of this question is,
yes, please.
It was a factual way the value. So we've thrown up quite a lot of sort of ideas and things here, you know, cut out a bit of space within an organization, trying to get a team across the Silicon Valley, maybe set up some sort of outpost, many things that people see today as quite trendy, quite fashionable, but also valuable. And is there a sort of a structured way you would take this, or do you believe the dialogue that you have with the organization determines the program? And how do you get, again, how can you get the innovator who's trying to sort of, you know, manage the leadership to listen?
Yeah.
How would you try to shape that?
Well, there is a structured approach. Honestly, if we had more time, I would walk you through the three phases that we go through when we build this innovation capability, this discipline of innovation. But one of the things I would ask the entrepreneurs and the team, and try to sort of start spreading a new narrative about what innovation is inside the organization, why it's needed. So so the there was an old model of expensive, slow moving, high investment R&D that sort of pervaded the industry and most industry. And now we're talking about sort of startup techniques, which are light, thin, quick, fast, accelerated learning. These are not huge, expensive efforts, right? So there's a different mindset around that. But maybe more importantly is the recognition that the world is not going to slow down, right? We are on Moore's Law, and that little microprocessor is doubling in capability and halving in cost. The moment you and I are having now will be the slowest technological moment we will experience in our whole lifetime. This is not slowing down, and the days of incremental improvement or 3 or 4% margins, maybe your death nail. That may be the going out of business in an exponential economy. Somebody may steal your lunch instantly. And so the organization...
I buy what you're saying here, Leslo, but sometimes people turn around and say, he's got the bubble of Silicon Valley around his head. You know, he's living in that confined atmosphere where we're talking 20s and 30s and 50s and 100 and magnificent expenses. We live in a real world out here, you know, where we've got a lot of unemployment, we've got a very slow matured markets, we've got declining populations. You know, we're struggling to get 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
Many people begin to sort of cut away when they hear the Silicon bubble sort of explanation. Now, how do you counter that?
So one part of my simple answer to that question is the world you look at when you look out your window, right? Is it one of scarcity or one of abundance? Right? You're describing a world of scarcity.
And the answer
to that question is whether you can innovate, right? If you can innovate, it's a world of abundance and we can survive by adapting, adjusting, and inventing our way in the future. If we can't, then we will be unemployed. We will go out of business slowly and painfully. That would be what I would challenge them around, right?
I love that, because let me just give you a quick one and then we'll go on to question three. There's a very, very large manufacturer of cars sitting in Germany. And, you know, there's a few of them, so I'll protect the innocent here. And the question was asked about, you know, how does he see his business? How's it growing? This is the chief executive. He stood up, walked to the window, looked down into the car park, and he says, "Can't you see how well we're doing?" Now, if you want to understand that, the point was nearly every car on that was a car from the company people. And I thought, what a distorted view
that
people have got. when you look out the window, because that was one of those moments where you saw a chief executive do that. And you thought, where do I start now to actually explain to him that that's not the window he should be looking out of?
I just heard from somebody the other day that Toyota, right, one of the most successful, largest car companies in the whole world, is now going to scale back their car production and pivot into robots. They believe robotic extensions for services and home use and all kinds of things will be the next big manufacturing revolution to hit. And so they, you know, when you watch places like that, or you listen to the guy at Amazon, Bezos, you recognize why they're so successful. And you look, you know, Fortune 500, have you heard these stats? The America's like Fortune 500, largest companies in the world, they were certainly in the United States. If I took you back 100 years, so the average time you were on that Fortune 500 list was about 80, 90 years, lifetime employment. It was a different world back in the 1920s, 1930s. Now, the average time on that list is 18 years. It's less than 20 years. The biggest companies in the world are being cycled out of that list on a regular basis, and it's only speeding up. So he may look out and see all those beautiful cars in his parking lot, but he or she should be careful.
We'll go on to question three, but I'll just comment with
this.
18 years and 9 chief executives usually nowadays, isn't it?
Very good. Touche. I like that. Yes, it is.
Let's have a pause and then we'll get into question three.